Thank you for being with us this night. And I did not, with the being away and speaking sometimes a couple of times a day, a couple of morning classes, I did not get to finish Galatians. I wanted to look at something I worked on before, I hope can be helpful to you, about Jesus and the Psalms of Lament. Lord willing, on Tuesday night, we will try to cover Psalm 143. Jesus and the Psalms of Lament. What do I mean by that? In Matthew 27, verse 34, in Mark 15, verse 34, the only statement of Jesus from the cross in those two gospels is, my God, why have you forsaken me? A quote from Psalm 22, verse 1. Go over to the Gospel of Luke. In Luke 23, verse 46, Jesus said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And then in John 19, verses 28 and 29, the Bible tells us that Jesus, in order to fulfill the scripture, cries out, I am thirsty. And a jar of sour wine was standing there. So they put the sponge full of sour wine upon the branch of the hyssop and brought it up to his mouth. Now, the statement, my God, why have you forsaken me? Quote from Psalm 22:1. Luke 23:46, Father, into your hand I commit my spirit, is a quote from Psalm 31 and verse 5. And when Jesus cries, I thirst, that's not a direct quote, but there are a couple of references to the psalmist being thirsty, as we'll see in Psalm 69, verses 20 and 21, and being given vinegar to drink that fit the circumstances of Jesus. So most writers believe that Psalm 69, John 19, verses 28 and 29, is making reference to Psalm 69, 20 and 21. This is my point. There are seven statements of Jesus from the cross. Three of them seem to quote these psalms of individual lament. What we want to do tonight is to look at one of these psalms of individual lament. We'll incorporate some other things, but look particularly at Psalm 69. As we look at Psalm 69, we then want to see how Jesus fulfills this and what that means. These psalms are very emotional. They're very poetic, so it's sometimes difficult to tell how literal the circumstances are. But they're very emotional as the writer is pouring out their grief, their pain, their heartache to God. And I hope we can see those elements. Psalm 69 in the heading says, for the choir director, according to Shashanim, a psalm of David. And he begins by saying, save me, O God, for the waters have threatened my life. I have sunk into deep mire, and there is no foothold. I have come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. I am weary with my crying. My throat is parched. My eyes fail while I wait for my God. Those who hate me without a cause are more than the hairs of my head. Those who would destroy me are powerful, being wrongfully my enemies. What I did not steal, I then have to repay. Now, I say these psalms are highly poetic. My guess is that this writer is standing on dry ground as we are. But while he is standing on dry ground, he describes his problem as if he is drowning. He says that waters have threatened his life in verse 1. In verse 2, he's come into deep waters and a flood overflows me. And in verse 2, he also said he sinks deeper and deeper in the mire and he can't find any place on which to rest his feet. So he is describing in deeply emotional terms his pain and his distress. And he feels like he is drowning. Have you ever said, I'm drowning, while you're standing on dry ground? The psalmist does this. And the psalmist is miserable. He says, I am weary, verse 3, with my crying. My throat is parched. I can remember one time calling a person after he had a particularly difficult day and difficult night, him saying that I cried and cried till I couldn't cry anymore. I'm weary with my crying. My throat is parched, and it's as if the writer is looking for help, and he looks for so long, and he looks so hard that his eyes fail. He's desperately desiring help. In verse 4, his enemies are more than the hairs of his head. Now, in Psalm 40, verse 12, the psalm speaks there, Psalm 40, verse 12, of his sins being more than the hairs of his head. Here, he said, my enemies, those who hate me without cause, are more than the hairs of my head. His enemies are many. His enemies are not only many, his enemies are mighty. The Bible says in verse 4, those who would destroy me are powerful. They are many, they are mighty, and they are malicious. They are wrongfully my enemies. What I did not steal, I then have to repay. So he is innocent. He has done no wrong, and yet his enemies are finding wrong. And they are powerful people. They are not insignificant people. And they are everywhere. In every direction he looks, he is surrounded by foes. This is a little bit of his distress. And he is begging for God to save him from the distress. But I also want you to notice that the text emphasizes that the reason he has been so mistreated, so shamed, is because of his love for God. In verse 5, he said, O God, it is you who knows my folly, and my wrongs are not hidden from you. May those who wait for you not be ashamed through me, O Lord of hosts. May those who seek you not be dishonored through me, O God of Israel. Because for your sake I have borne reproach. Dishonor has covered my face. For your sake I have borne reproach. His loyalty to God was the reason why he has cried so hard and so long. His loyalty to God is the reason why his enemies are so many. He has become estranged, verse 8. I have become estranged from my brothers, an alien to my mother's sons, those closest to him, those in the most intimate relationship with him, are estranged from him, an alien to him, not wanting anything to do with him. In verse 9, for zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who have reproached you have fallen on me. When I wept in my soul with fasting, it became my reproach. When I made sackcloth my clothing, I became a byword to them. Those who sit in the gate talk about me. I am the song of drunkards. Now again, back in verse 7, for your sake, I've borne reproach. In verse 9, zeal for your house has consumed me. And therefore, because of this, everyone who hated God poured out their hatred upon him. The reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. And sometimes his sadness, his brokenness led him to weep and fast. But even that was used as a reason to ridicule him, to mock him. It became my reproach. When he made sackcloth his clothing, he's a byword, a reproach, a byword. Words that are often applied to people because of their sin, but here applied to him because of his loyalty to God. At some point, particularly in classes, I have used the term merism. What a merism does is it takes things on a totally opposite side of the perspective horizon, and it emphasizes those two opposites in order to stress that not only is it true at those opposites, but it's true at everything in between. I hope I explained that well, but let me show this with verse 12. He said, those who sit in the gate talk about me. Those who sit in the gate. Who sat in the gate? It was the leaders of the people that often sat in the gate. Important business was transacted in the city. And remember, the virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 is known because her husband sits in the gate. To sit in the gate was a place of prominence, a place of importance. That seat showed you are somebody. And he mentions those who sit in the gate on one side of the horizon. They are the most respected in society. But on the other side of society, in verse 12, are the drunkards. And he is mocked by both of these groups, the most dignified and the least dignified, and he is mocked by everybody in between. Those who sit in the gate talk about me. I am the song of drunkards. And this led him to many broken hearts and shedding many tears. And a friend was a difficult thing to find. In verse 18, oh, draw near to my soul and redeem it. Ransom me because of my enemies. You know my reproach and my shame and my dishonor. All my adversaries are before you. Reproach has broken my heart. I am so sick. I looked for sympathy, but there was none. And for comforters, but I found none. They gave me gall also for my food. And for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. He begs God's loving kindness. That word was used at verse 13. And at verse 16, he begs God's loving kindness. He begs God's mercy. But he finds no comfort from man and no relief from man. We're not going to deal extensively. I just want to mention the rest of the psalm after verse 21. He has an imprecatory section where he is begging that the treatment that he received fall upon his enemies. For example, in verse 21, they gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. And then he prays in verse 22, may their table before them become a snare. When they are in peace, may it become a trap. Just as I was acutely aware when I ate and drank, because of what I was eating, because of what I was drinking, I was acutely aware of my opposition and my pain. May that be the same for them. In verse 22, in verse 23, may their eyes grow dim. You remember back in verse 3 that he stated, my eyes fail while I wait for the Lord. But what is fascinating about these individual psalms of lament is, in spite of their pain, in spite of their anguish, almost all of them end on a note of praise to God. Praise or thanksgiving. I think that is highly significant, and we want to allude to that later. Now, we could have dealt with Psalm 69 more extensively, but I want you to see how frequently this psalm is used of Jesus. The sermon is Psalm 69 and Jesus. The phrase, they hated me without a cause, is used in John 15, 25, when Jesus, on the night before his crucifixion, talks about being hated without a cause. Now, there are a couple of other places in the Psalms you see that kind of language. For example, Psalm 35, 19. So this is not the only place in the Psalms where you see that language, but you do see it in Psalm 69, verse 4. And so it's at least included in that passage. You remember how verse 9 is quoted in the New Testament. Zeal for your house has consumed me. Zeal for your house has consumed me. Remember when Jesus cleansed the temple in John 2, and John put at the beginning of his gospel and the others at the end. It may be Jesus cleansed the temple twice. It may be that it's put in a different order for theological purposes. But when Jesus cleansed the temple, his disciples remembered the statement, zeal for your house has consumed me. They think back on these words of Psalm 69 and apply them to Jesus when Jesus cleansed the temple. In Romans 15, verse 3, the other part of verse 9 is used. The reproaches of those who reproached you have fallen on me. This is taken and applied to Jesus. As Romans 15, 3 says, for even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you have fallen upon me. So, quoting Psalm 69, 9, Romans 15, 3 applies it to Jesus. We have already mentioned that it may be, it's most likely to me, that when Jesus cries, I thirst, though that's not the exact words of John 19, verses 28 and 29, that what is said in Psalm 69, verses 20 and 21, fits that circumstance the most closely. Reproaches broken my heart, I am sick, I looked for sympathy, but there was none, for comforters, but I found none. They gave me gall for my food, for my thirst, they gave me vinegar to drink. even that part of the psalm that we did not look at as closely, one of those parts we did not look at as closely, Psalm 69:25, is applied to Judas as an enemy of Jesus. May their camp be desolate and none dwell in their tents. That's applied to Judas in Acts 1:20. I want to carefully phrase a couple of statements here, and I ask you to listen, because the distinction I'm making here is significant. Psalm 69, obviously, is fulfilled in Jesus. But Psalm 69 is not exclusively fulfilled in Jesus. And not only do I say that, I don't say here, I think, I'm not putting any qualifiers on this. I say, I know. You know how I can say that? Well, one, and that should be verse 5. Oh God, it is you who knows my folly, and my wrongs are not hidden from you. Where in the Gospels does Jesus ever speak that way? I guess some have a protest to that. Where in the Gospels does Jesus ever speak like that? Jesus said, which of you can convict me of sin? In John 8, verse 46. Jesus was tempted in all points like as we are, yet he without sin. Jesus never says, oh God, you know my foolishness. My wrongs are not hidden from you, because he did no wrong. And every New Testament writer appeals to the innocence of Jesus. It's not exclusively of Jesus. Now, that is the key point that I can really build and hang my hat on and say, I know that's the case. But there's another point that can be made to just show a difference between this psalm and Jesus. Not that I don't think there's a place for both in a biblical story, but I would say that there is a contrast between the writer of Psalm 69, who makes imprecatory statements, who calls down judgment upon those who oppose him, and Jesus on the cross praying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, I think not only, I think this is the case, not only with Psalm 69, but also with Psalm 31 and Psalm 22. But I ask you to look at those Psalms in your own time. Study them. Think carefully through them. It is hard to find three more pain-filled Psalms than those three. 22, 31, and 69. It is significant to me that Jesus takes a passage where obviously David was first speaking of his own experiences when he talks about his folly and his wrongs. He takes a passage where he is first speaking of his own folly, his own wrongs, but Jesus takes his words of pain, maybe as he was being chased by Saul, maybe as during that time of his life when he said to Jonathan, there is but a step between me and death. And he takes those Psalms and he makes them his own. Why is it, if God is good, why is it that there is such suffering? God truly enters into our suffering in the most intimate ways. Coming here, not shielding himself from pain, but fully entering it. We're going to come back to that point. I want us to make both a doctrinal point of this and a practical point. A doctrinal point, a practical point. First, the doctrinal point. This is a question. Can we apply Old Testament passages to Jesus that the New Testament doesn't specifically quote and apply to Jesus? Can we do that? Now, I have to tell you, and I honestly cannot remember the source, because I do not think it was so much in the preaching that I heard, but in the books that I was reading, in the articles I was reading as a younger Christian, but the impression I got was the answer was no. We can't apply a New Testament passage, an Old Testament passage to Jesus that the New Testament doesn't specifically quote and apply to him. Now, what I generally say if I find myself in a disagreement with someone about this point, remember Daniel 2, and remember that image, the head of gold and the chest of silver and the arms, the belly and thighs of bronze and the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay. And remember how the Bible says in the days of these kings, the Roman king, the last group that was mentioned, God will set up a kingdom. Can any of you remember a sermon or Bible class where that has been applied to Jesus and the establishment of his kingdom? Now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, and some of you may not raise your hand remembering this, even though a couple did raise their hand. Some of you may not say not raise your hand that probably did hear it that way. But do you know something? The New Testament doesn't specifically quote Daniel 2 like that and apply it to Jesus. So what I'm saying, even though some say no, there are some cases that seem so clear that we say yes. What I am saying is the Old Testament is 3 times longer than the New Testament. And I think what the New Testament does is it gives us a way, a lens through which to view the Old Testament that we can apply to Old Testament passages, even if they're not specifically included or specifically quoted in the New Testament. The New Testament gives us a way of seeing the Old Testament. Now, this is both, what I'm about to say is both theological and practical, but it was before the other practical point I'm going to make. I was in a study recently, and we were looking at some things in the book of Job. And you remember the story of Job. You remember Job 1 and 2 well. Where Job lost all of his wealth and he lost his children. Can you imagine bearing 10 children on one day? Then Satan strikes Job from the foot of his sole of his foot to the crown of his head with boils, and every place is full of pain. I know my father has told me before that one of the most painful things he's ever experienced, the most painful thing he ever remembered experiencing, was shingles. And I picture this kind of like that. And not only does he have to deal with the emotional pain of all the loss he has experienced in his family, he has to deal with the physical pain of not having a moment of peace. Now add to that, in a society where it was believed that if you were righteous, if you were righteous, you'd be blessed. If you were wicked, you would suffer. All his friends draw the conclusion, Job, you must have sinned to bring this on yourself. I can remember once seeing the story of a man whose wife was murdered. They found out shortly he was accused of this murder. And he was even about to go to trial when they convicted the real killer. They found the real killer. Can you imagine the emotional pain of losing someone so close and then not only to lose them, to be accused of that? I can't imagine that. And Job, in a way, is accused of that. You caused the death of your children by that. In Job 19, verses 13 through 20, Job says, I am estranged from everybody, from my wife, from my friends, even my servants. I have to beg them to get them to do anything. And in Job 29, Job says, I was the highest, the most respected of the most respected. And in Job 30, I was the most despised by everybody. When I read Job, the question comes to my mind and my soul. Was it fair of God to put Job through this? This subject helps me with that. None of those passages on the board that I mentioned are used to speak of Jesus' suffering on the cross. None of them. But understanding our principle is that passages about sufferers who are seeking to follow God, who are seeking to do His will, have a greater fulfillment in Jesus, a principle that I hope I communicated well from Psalm 69. That passage tells me that I should see Job's sufferings in light of Jesus. And I will say this, when we look at Jesus' suffering, Job's suffering becomes more understandable as a result. For example, God told Satan in Job 1 in verse 12, put forth your hand, but do not touch him. You're not to touch Job. And then finally, when he gives Satan the permission to touch Job, he said, don't take his life. No such limitations were placed on Jesus coming into this world. No such limitations. Jesus, as he's arrested, is forsaken by all of his disciples, just as Job was estranged from those closest to him. He stood alone in the halls of Pilate. And if we think it was a step down for Job to go from being the most respected of society to being the most degraded, what was it like for Jesus to have dwelt in heaven in need of nothing, to be God from all eternity, and to come down to earth to live as a man and to be rejected by the lowest of the low, those who are crucified with him, comparable to the drunkards of Psalm 69, verse 12, they mocked him. And when I read the story of Naboth, minding his own business, when offered by King Ahab, hey, really like your property? Really like your vineyard? I'll give you a better one. I'll pay you whatever you want. No, I shouldn't depart with the inheritance. I shouldn't give up the inheritance the Lord has given me. Ahab goes home. He's pouting. His wife says, what are you pouting about? And he said, Naboth won't sell me his vineyard. And she says, aren't you the king of Israel? I'll get that vineyard for you. You don't worry about that. And so she writes letters. She writes letters in Ahab's name and seals it with Ahab's seal and says, you call a fast. You call a fast to the people and you put Naboth in a prominent place, Naboth and his sons. You put them in a prominent place and you have worthless men stand up and say, he cursed God and cursed the king. And then you take him outside the city and stone him. And they followed Jezebel's suggestions with sinister perfection. Naboth was conspired against by the leaders of the land. They accuse him of blasphemy. They take him outside the city and they stone him. Do those facts ring a bell with you? What I'm saying, Jesus truly enters into our pain and suffering in a way that is beyond our ability to explain or even conceive. It is not without accident that when Saul was on the road to Damascus to persecute Christians, the voice that spoke from heaven says, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Me. Not them, not the church, but me. Truly, Jesus enters into our suffering. That's why he takes three of the most passionate and pain-filled psalms, which I think have an original fulfillment in those who prayed them. He takes them and makes them his own in the cross, because when Jesus came to this earth and lived as a man and suffered and died for us and was raised from the dead, when that happens, he truly enters into our pain as the deepest level. And maybe that is not adequate in saying that. Because I hope that neither I nor you experience the pain that he experienced. I cannot imagine it. When we are broken, when we are discouraged, when you are at your lowest point, at your darkest night, know that he has been there and he is there. He truly enters into our suffering. And he gives us strength in the midst of suffering. In Hebrews 2, verses 17 and 18, therefore he had to be made like his brethren in all things, so he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. Jesus went through the things that you go through, that I go through, living in this world. He went through them to a higher degree. than most anyone will. I mean, he was opposed, he was ignored, he was hated, he was murdered for his loyalty to God. And he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. When you have done the right thing, and everyone around you laughs or mocks or accuses, he was there long before we were there. And he is able to give you strength in the midst of trial. Understanding how Jesus entered our pain helps us to love him more. One of the songs that we sang earlier, and I'm not going to get this right, he knew he would redeem me. Whatever the cost. You know, I didn't get it right, but you know what I'm saying. I heard this story this past week. There was a lady in the church where I went to preach. When I first met her, the preacher whispered to me, she is from Vietnam. She's been a Christian. She's lived here many years, and she's been a Christian many years. But she just went to see someone in the family there in Vietnam who had been in hospice, and she went to see them for the last time. And that was all I learned about her at that moment. Later in the week, I was told the story that she has two brothers there who are preachers. And a couple of years ago, in communist Vietnam, they just disappeared. No one knew where they were. For about a year, the family had already tried to accept the fact that they were dead. They resurfaced. They were alive. But they had had some kind of encounter with their government. So that every time when they go to their congregation and preach on the first day of the week, they have to turn on a camera, watched by their government to see if they approve. One, that just makes us thankful for a situation. But think about going to a country like that and preaching. Not knowing whether you would make it out alive. Jesus came to our world. Jesus, who was immune from death, came to our world knowing he would not make it out alive. And my last point about these Psalms of Lament, it's tied to Jesus from the fact that Jesus not only suffered, but Jesus raised from the dead. Jesus was raised from the dead. And I want to tell you something about these Psalms of Lament. It is striking, as I stated earlier, that almost every one of them, Psalm 88 is an exception, and there may be a couple of other exceptions, but Psalm 88 is a drastic, dramatic exception. Almost all of them end on a note of praise. And I will tell you, these Psalms of Lament are messages to us The fact they end on a note of praise, that if we keep trusting in God, if we keep turning to God, if we keep throwing ourselves upon God and His mercy, God will ultimately turn our lament into praise. Because Jesus, who entered our suffering, also was raised from the dead. If we hold on to Him and don't let go, in the midst of our pain, in the midst of our agony, we don't forget Him. We continue to cry to Him for help. Ultimately, our lament will end in the joy of praising His presence throughout eternity. I hope I explained these things clearly. Thank you for listening. It may be that your life is full of pain, and that's caused you to seek God. I would say, don't forget, in the midst of all our other problems, that our biggest problem is sin. And we desperately need His forgiveness. And if we can help you tonight in receiving His forgiveness, we see people in the New Testament believing that Jesus died and rose again. We see them turning from their sins in repentance and being baptized to have their sins washed away. And if we can help you in that, we want to, as we stand and sing.